Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. As we prepare to observe the national holiday in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King, much will be written and much will be said referencing the life, times, and dream of Dr. King. The question will be asked, as it always is, how much of his dream of fairness, equal opportunity, and justice has been fulfilled since his death in 1968? The fact we are still asking the question may, in and of itself, be an answer. Joining us is noted political commentator, economist, author, and educator, Julianne Malveaux. Dr. Malveaux will be in St. Louis on January 21st to speak at the University of Missouri-St. Louis observance of the King holiday. She is president emeritus of Bennett College in North Carolina. Julianne Malveaux joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. It is such a pleasure to have a chance to talk to you, Dr. Malveaux.
Well, Don, it's great to be with you as well. Thanks for inviting me.
We're looking forward to seeing you in person here in St. Louis in a week or two.
Great.
I'd like to begin by reading the last paragraph of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. I reread it yesterday. Here it is. When we allow freedom to ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last. My question to you, Dr. Malveaux, are we there yet? How much of rights and opportunities improved?
You know, it's very interesting, first of all, that I'd be visiting St. Louis on the official inauguration day. Of course, the president's inaugurated on the 20th by law, but the big parties will be on the 21st. Mm-hmm. And lots of people will be talking about progress, because I think certainly the election of President Obama is more historic in 2012 than it was in 2008. And I think the reason is because a lot of people didn't think that this was going to be a back-to-back. Lots of people, and you know, the election wasn't as close as many predicted, but it was close. And until October, people were really worried, especially given the president's, frankly, poor performance in the first debate. So people were concerned about it. And so the back-to-back election of President Obama gives lots of people the opportunity to talk about us being in a, quote, post-racial society. But I don't think we live in a post-racial society, and I'm not singing yet. We've got a lot of disparities. The unemployment report just came out last week, and we see still, as always, African-American unemployment at almost twice that of whites. We see any number of differentials. We can see those differentials in education. We can see them in terms of health, and that doesn't mean access to health care, attitudes about health. There's so many disparities that still exist. The question is often, you know, especially from whites, well, what do you want? Well, what should we do? But people, if you read all of Dr. King, if you read him in a body, he talks about the disparities. He, you know, in I think it's in Where Do We Go From Here, he has a statement. He says, but half of all Negroes live in substandard housing, and Negroes have half the income of whites. We turn to the negative experiences of life. The Negro has a double share. Infant mortality rate is double that of whites. There are twice as many Negroes in combat in Vietnam at the beginning of 1967, and twice as many Negro soldiers died in action in the proportion of their numbers of the population as whites. Now, obviously, much of this is dated. This was written in 1967, but the line that jumps out at you is, when we turn to the negative experience of life, the Negro has a double share. And that, while we couldn't call it double today, it's a higher share. We look at still things like infant mortality. We look at, again, education. We look at educational access. And you just have to say, it's not equal yet. It's not fair yet. And it's not even not equal, but it's not even equal access yet. Many talk about access versus outcomes, but we're not even there yet. We've got an African-American president, which I think is wonderful, but I think African-American people have learned in the last 4 years that he is the president of all America, not the president of black America. So when you see these high unemployment rates, the question comes up, well, what can President Obama do? And the answer is, he's in such a precarious position that it's not likely that he's going to do anything, quote, for black people. Now, this, again, speaks to inequality. If Appalachia had the unemployment rates that African Americans do, somebody would figure out a program to target Appalachia, but no one can target African American people. So is it equal yet? Are we singing yet? I don't think so.
But why does this disparity remain? I mean, laws are in place, supposedly, to see to it that these issues should be corrected.
Well, there are three reasons why it's in place. One, you have a differential level of education between African Americans and whites. So we could parse that down, but on its face, that's one reason why we have the disparity. A second reason that we have the disparity has to do with spatial location. In other words, there are places where African American people live where the jobs aren't. And so, and then we look at poor public transportation in inner cities, not only are the jobs not there, but it would be difficult to get there. But the third reason, and I don't know which of these would you rank higher, but the third reason is just plain old discrimination. If you put in an application, your name is Tamika, same application by Tammy, Tammy will get the job before Tamika will. You see young men and women with African-sounding names. Their applications are likely to be thrown in the slush pile. Now, this is something that's not evidentiary, but there are economists who looked at some of these issues in terms of the other things that matter. Here's another piece of that in terms of discrimination. African-American people have less fully developed networks than, you know, whites and maybe other minorities do. So if you go to any place, you go to, I look at the airport, some of the airport shops, and you see some of the people with literally the same ethnicity, and you want to say, gee, how'd you get this job? But you know how they got the job, a friend of a friend of a friend. If there are very few African-Americans in there, their friends are friends of friends, don't necessarily have the access. So some of it is active discrimination, some of it is passive discrimination, and some of it is some of those differences that are socioeconomic, but that matter. For example, Don, when you talk about differences in education, one might say on its face the fact that about 18% of African Americans over 25, about 28% of whites over 25 have college degrees. Well, that gap is closing, but why does the gap still exist? Or why is it that an African-American who graduates from high school has roughly three times the unemployment rate of a white who graduates from high school? And from an earning perspective, will earn a fraction what a white graduating from high school earns. Now, we know graduating from high school is not the ideal. We're pushing students towards college and vocational ed. But when you look at people on their face, there is an inequality that basically speaks to discrimination.
You know, and the gaps that you're speaking of may, in fact, widen in the months and years ahead if the Supreme Court acts as many people suspect that it will on the issue of affirmative action. It may cause that gap to become even wider.
That's exactly right. And there you have a percentage of the white population who really doesn't believe that we need affirmative action anymore, that we need any race-specific policies anymore. And they will get extremely angry, quite frankly, when you start talking about this stuff. They've got these anecdotal stories about how the daughter of a black doctor was admitted before the daughter of a white working-class family, but they don't know the whole story. Did the doctor pay full tuition, you know, while the working-class family was asking for, let's say, some kind of a subsidy or scholarship? And one of the other challenges, really, having just stepped down as president of a historically black college, is that scholarship money is just hard to find. It's really very difficult. So I had students who would finish college, but they'd finish it in 6 or 7 years because they come in, they drop out to save more money. And, you know, we would have liked to support them fully, but the dollars were just not there. And, you know, in higher education, when you made the shift between need-based financial aid and merit-based financial aid, what you essentially did was cut a number of African-American young people out of the mix.
Well, how do we change or begin to change all these many years after Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech? How do we begin to change attitudes?
Well, first of all, I think that people have to be committed. I think that often people are not committed, especially when they're non-African-American. I mean, equality should not be a black issue. Equality should be a national issue. The whole issue of access should be a national issue. It shouldn't just be a black issue. And I find some, but the whites who are committed to this are really in the minority. More of them feel like, okay, we had the civil rights movement, we had this, we had that, now I'm finished with it. I think another issue that has shifted consciousness certainly is the increasing population in the United States of the Latino community. So many people that, okay, we've got some other minorities on the scene that we have to pay attention to. Well, why not pay attention to everybody? You don't do it like Noah's Ark, one by one or two by two. we have inequality issues that are based on race, that are based on class, that are based on ethnicity, and we shouldn't want to have any of those.
You know, I'm sure you're familiar with an Associated Press poll that came out recently, probably a week or two ago, and I'll just read part of it here for those who aren't familiar with it. 51% of America has anti-black attitudes. That's up from 48% in 2008. It was even higher during the recent political campaign, up around 57% from, as I recall, those figures. But 52% also express anti-Hispanic attitudes. That really tells us an awful lot, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, what you see is a reluctance to change. I mean, I really see this period as very parallel to the period after the Civil War in Reconstruction, where essentially what had happened is that during the Civil War, you had the Freedmen's Bureau, you had a number of things that attempted to create equal access in an equal situation. This was the bureau that was supposed to provide 40 acres and a mule to African-American people who had been enslaved and who basically needed to get an economic foot in the system. But what you also had, and I think even today, you have people in some parts of the South who don't know that they lost the Civil War. They're just not clear about that. And so when you saw the post-Reconstruction era, you saw the institution of black codes, which were you can't walk on this side of the street or that. I mean, you really saw the resurgence of not only discrimination, but almost slavery. You would see, you know, the sort of peonage system, the land rent system. If you walk down the parts of the South, and I certainly wasn't there in 1876, but if you walk down those parts, many people wrote about how it looked just like slavery. Now we have a situation where we've got this phenomenal African-American president who's leading our country in an exemplary way, and you got a backlash. You've got a backlash, and those are where some of those racial attitudes come from. I think you see, and it's very troubling, the disrespect to the first family, the comments that float up on the Internet. Now, you know, any fool has Internet access, so we won't basically make any conclusions based on that. But some of the comments that come up, some of the comments that come up about the girls, Malia and Sasha, some of the comments about, of course, Michelle Obama. I mean, I have never seen, and we've had first ladies of every body size and type, I've never seen a, you know, radio talk show commentator joined by a member of Congress talking about a first lady's body type. I mean, so it's almost as if the respect that usually goes with the office does not go for the Obamas. But even more than that, the backlash shows up in the everyday life of many African-American people. People feel free to say things that they wouldn't have said 10 years ago. And their permission is this notion of a post-racial era where race doesn't matter.
That's author, labor economist, political commentator Julianne Malveaux, president emeritus of Bennett College in North Carolina. She is with us for the remainder of the hour, and I would like to encourage our listeners to get into this conversation. There are many provocative things to discuss, and Dr. Malveaux is a perfect person to discuss them with. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on Air. You can also reach us through Facebook. What still needs to be done to fulfill Dr. King's dream? Do you have an answer to that question? This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our conversation with Dr. Julianne Malveaux. By the way, Dr. Malveaux is the featured guest at the University of Missouri-St. Louis's Martin Luther King Observance Day on Monday, January 21st. She indicated that a couple of moments ago. It's Inauguration Day. That's going to be at 10 a.m. on the Two Hill. We have more information on our website. Dr. Malveaux, obviously you're a fan of President Obama's, but his critics would say, and even some of his supporters would say, that he hasn't done enough speaking out on the issue of racism and racial issues in this country. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the president needs to be more aggressive about racial inequality. I think, of course, he has to put it in context. What, you know, when you look at this president, again, I think he walks on a tightrope. He's a president of all America, not the president of black America. And therefore, he has to consider any number of things. But as I said earlier, if you found out that the unemployment rate in Appalachia was 13.3%, and or if white men had an unemployment rate of 13.3%, I think someone would say, okay, we've got to do something to target this population because this population is having a hard time. However, that's something that has not happened. And I think this president could do better. I don't think he has to go out and give a great speech on race, but I think that, for example, the Secretary of Labor, Hilda Solis, could do more. I think that there are others, you know, that could do more. One of the things that I learned on in leadership as a college president, and it's something that I hadn't really learned before because I'm a pretty much in-your-face person, is that there are a lot of things you need to delegate. There are a lot of things you don't need to do yourself. So President Obama doesn't have to give a big race speech, but what if he deputized Secretary Solis to say, this is an issue, let's deal with it. You know, so I don't necessarily need him to put his fist up in the air and to thump on the chest, but I need him to do some policy things to make a difference.
He seems to be leaning in that direction a little more now than was the case in the first term. And I'm thinking particularly of Joe Biden with regard to the fiscal cliff discussions, and now he's appointed Biden to come up with some sort of ideas for gun control. So he is moving somewhat in that direction.
Well, he's moving in that direction on some issues. But for example, he's generated a lot of criticism from Cornel West and Tavis Smiley about poverty. And they've been going around the country with their poverty tour. Meanwhile, Vice President Biden chaired a task force on the middle class. And so my question would be, why not have someone inside the White House or closely outside, Secretary of HHS, do something on poverty? I mean, these are things that could be done, and these are things that haven't been done. So I think that President Obama has certainly, you know, earned the criticism that he's gotten, and I think that he's not done a good job in responding to it. Now, on a scale of 1 to 10 overall, you know, I give him an 8. On a scale of dealing with Black America, dealing with poverty, dealing with those issues, I give him a 4.
Did you notice, as many people did, that during the recent political campaign, the national political campaign, there was very, very little discussion of poverty?
There was hardly any. I mean, even when you looked at the debates, I mean, you could count on one hand the number of times poverty came up. I mean, I think that we've got our heads in the sand about poverty. It's an issue. I mean, nearly 15% of all Americans live in poverty. 27% of African Americans live in poverty. 26% of Latinos. With this level of poverty, we have a world, I mean, a historic high in the number of people who are receiving food stamps. Given these things, it would seem to me that this would be something that is a focus and a thrust of this administration. However, what we've seen, quite frankly, is a hostility to poverty. We see almost an official position by the part of some legislators that the poor are responsible for themselves, that, you know, we don't have anything to do with that, which is insanity. But, and again, we have our heads in the sand. And Dr. King really did speak to this issue on many occasions in his writing. He wrote, in 1968, and I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, he said, I'm only slightly paraphrasing, there are 40 million poor people in America. And you have to ask yourself, what kind of system creates that many poor people? And he said, this really has to do with the economic system, with the structure of the economic system. He goes on to say, who owns the oil? Who owns the iron ore? If the world is two-thirds water, why do we pay water bills? You know, now my tongue-in-cheek remark is, you know, don't pay the water bill, send Dr. King's statement and see what happens. But the fact is that he's really talking about who owns the means of production and who's outside it. As he said, what kind of country creates 40 million poor people? And that's a question we have to ask. There are many people in this country who are doing extremely well. There are many who've been hit. In the past 4 years, really the past five since 2007, when we saw the banks go down, others go down, we've seen a lot of pain and poverty, a lot of people who've lost their homes, a lot of people who've lost their jobs, many who have not been able to bounce back. But we've also seen a lot of wealth created. The stock market on Friday went up on the news that the unemployment rate was steady. That always just puzzles me. So, you know, Dr. King really asked us to talk about economic structure, and it's something that no one wants to talk about.
I wish I had the quote in front of me, but I know you're familiar with it, and that is dealing with the check and check marked insufficient funds.
Oh, yeah, I can. Exactly. Since we've come to the nation's capital to cash a check, and the check has been marked insufficient funds. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it's in the, I don't know, I believe it may be in the, I have no, it's in the, not only I Have a Dream speech, it's in the 63 speech, which everybody from that speech remembers people, I have a dream that people will be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. And that's the I have a dream. People, you know, will quote that ad nauseum, but very few people will quote the cash a check.
Let's go to the phones. We have a number of people who want to talk with you, Dr. Malveaux. We'll begin with Norma, calling from St. Louis. Norma, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. And, you know, this idea of ethnicity or race being part of what the president should deal with or anybody should deal with is really an issue of the ruling class who rules the oil, who rules the water, who controls the money, not so much that we are of different colors, but those people that have that control happen to be primarily in this country white, and they also happen to be way over 30. And these polls are looking, are talking to the people who are 30 and over, and they also harbor these same racial prejudices. But I notice in my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren, they do not have that kind of idea about race. For them, it is about getting ahead, but it is not about the color of your skin. Their friends are multicolored. They're more diverse. So in that respect, I think we will move on as time moves us on, where race or the color of one's skin is not the issue. But who rules the goal will continue to be the issue. Thank you.
Norma, thanks for the call. I'm glad she brought this subject up, Dr. Malveaux. What do you think? You deal with a lot of very young people. Are you seeing the same way Norma does?
Yes and no. I think that young, well-educated people, many have moved. Their racial attitudes are very different from those of their parents and grandparents. They mix together. They hang out together. But, where do these skinheads come from? These are young white people. Where do these people who pick up guns and go shoot stuff up come from? These are young white people. And they not young white people, let's just make it plain, young white men. These are people, in my opinion, and there's been a little bit of work on it, who feel marginalized. And in feeling marginalized, the question becomes, who marginalized you? In Oakland, California, we had one of the shoot-ups where it was at a school that was largely a college that was largely Asian. And so I think often you'll hear these young white men in their displacement taking it out on other people. Now, some of them, frankly, are deficient. They haven't done the work they need to do to make themselves competitive in labor markets. Instead, they are blaming young African Americans, young Latinos for the space they haven't had. So, again, while there are many who have changed their views, there are many who have not. And it really disturbs me when you see young whites under the age of 25 who ought to know better, who've been exposed, who are still as angry as their parents were, who still use freely the N-word, who still, can be very, not only rude, because rude in a quarter will get you a paper, but beyond being rude can be racially dismissive. And these are some of the kinds of things that we still see in our country. I would like to be as optimistic as Norma is, but go to Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama. I don't want to pick on Mississippi, but some of these states, you still have a kind of discrimination that you might have had 20 or 30 years ago.
What about young blacks? One of the things that I wonder about, you look at baseball players, black baseball players today, many of whom don't know who Jackie Robinson was.
Mm-hmm.
What about young black people today? Do they understand what happened during the 60s, who Martin Luther King was, and what the objectives were, and where they are today fully? Are their parents telling them?
That's a really interesting and very good question. Some parents tell, some parents don't. We have to do a better job, both in high school education and in college education, to teach some of these things. Quite frankly, I think it would be great if we required all students, not just African-American students, to do something on African-American history at the college level. Having spent 5 years with young women, ages, 18, basically 18 to 26, but some older, some younger, a lot of folks don't see race the same way that my generation sees race. I may see it first or second. They may see it fifth or sixth. Something discriminatory happens, they don't see race. They're like, maybe the person was busy, as opposed to I was at a hotel with one of my students once, and literally the clerk went around us to register people. He registered, there was a line, but he registered a couple people, and I said, yo, we're next, and he ignored me, and then finally came. And I called his boss, and I said, look, I find it very interesting that this guy went around us and registered, you know, four white people before he got to us. And the boss said, well, I'm sorry, why do you think it has to do with race? I said, well, it's the only variable I see. Now, maybe there's something else that I'm missing. I said, but the variable here I see is race. And so my student said to me, she said, well, doc, they could have been busy. Mm-hmm. You know, she was not going to jump to race first. She was going to maybe jump to a third or fourth. And I think that's the difference is younger African-Americans seem somewhat less race conscious. Again, like young whites, they kind of hang out with everybody. Their social lives are not, you know, race specific. And they are, until racism hits them upside the head, they really deny the impact of race. Now, when it does hit them upside the head, suddenly they get it. I think historically black colleges in particular do a great job of teaching, but, you know, everyone tells us that it's not a joke. It's a horrible joke about a child who, young person who saw Malcolm X and said Malcolm the 10th. you know, and it's happened. You have young folks sure. who don't know, you know, a lot about our history. And I think that that's a challenge. If you don't know history, then you're looking at the present with the laws on the books and everything else and say, you know, it's okay, it's fair. But race-neutral laws often have race implications. Give you an example. We're having a conversation as we speak in the Senate and the House about Social Security. And in order to save money with Social Security, a number of options have come up. One of them is to raise the Social Security age to age 70. Now, for folks like you and me, Don, that's not going to be a particular hardship. We earn our livings by running our mouths, by writing. This is not hard work. It may be challenging work, but let's talk about the 70-year-old waitress, the 70-year-old construction worker. They're ready to go at 62. You know, so when you begin to raise the unemployment rate, it has a race base because African-American people tend to be lower on the totem pole in terms of employment. It also has, as Nora pointed out, a class base because, again, you have people, you have 80-year-old senators, 80-plus, who are probably saying, well, I made it to 70. And you want to give them a hammer and say, okay, let's see you do some construction work and see how long you last.
I'll take a senator's pension plan any day of the week, and I'm sure you would too.
Absolutely. But, you know, again, the point is that people think they're doing race-neutral policy, but it has a racial implication. And this is something that people don't want to talk about. They don't want to talk about race.
We can call it and be polite and call it unintended consequences.
Exactly.
Let's take a call from Rashad. He's been waiting patiently. Thanks for doing so, Rashad. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Hi. I'm enjoying the discussion. Doctor, I would take issue with you. I don't think it's you will misdiagnose the problem if you will quote Martin Luther King of 50 years ago. You know, I can quote Muhammad Ali when he said that the Viet Cong ain't never called me no N-word. You know, but that doesn't properly diagnose the situation today. In 1940, I think it was 87% of African Americans were in poverty, but it wasn't. It was basically because of racism and lack of opportunity. And coming out of that, you know, there were certain programs that were necessary. But today, the overwhelming cause for African-American poverty is not racism. It's, as you probably know, I know you know about statistics, you know, about the out-of-wedlock child birth rate. That contributes to poverty more than anything else. And one of the comments, in regards to Chavis Smiley and Cornel West, I believe they've done a disservice to the African-American community. Chavis, because I think he was slighted because the president didn't take off his campaign to come to his affair in New Orleans. And ever since then, it seemed like he's been trying to flatten the tires on Barack Obama's, you know, going to the procession, you know, to become the president of the United States. And every time he's on the radio, he badmouths, he has guests on there that has a contradictory, you know, opinion to Barack Obama. So the Chavis Smiley and Cornel West, you know, I think they really do a disservice to the African-American community.
Well,
I just want to get your response to that. Go ahead.
Okay, two aspects that I respond to. First of all, while I think that there is some animus that's inappropriate in terms of Tavis and Cornell, and they're both personal friends. I think there's some animus that's inappropriate. I think that their focus on poverty is perfectly appropriate. As Don said earlier, and as many people have observed, the word poverty is just off the table. And whether the poverty is because of single-headed households, because of insufficient income, there is a poverty issue in this country. One in six Americans, not one in six African Americans, one in six Americans is poor. More than one in four African Americans is poor. So these are issues that we have to deal with, and I think that Tavis and Cornell are bringing light to those issues, and they should not be faulted for it. The issues of personal animus, I think that they should be discussed, and they should be faulted for those. But I think the poverty issue transcends any notion of animus. Now, regarding the 50-year quotes and the 40-year quotes, my point, and I think Don's as well, in raising these quotes is that there are some things that have not significantly changed. Again, I would say half of, when we turn to the negative experiences of life, the Negro has a double share. If we look at things like infant mortality, let's just take poverty off the table for a minute. I'm going to come back to it. Look at infant mortality. We look at access to health care. Some of these things, you still see what Dr. King said. You look at college attendance. We have, it's not half anymore, but there is a differential. And so I think that that needs to be dealt with. Now, you are among the many who would ascribe poverty to the number of households headed by women. I have two responses to that. First of all, pay women equal pay, and then you won't have as much of a problem. The fact is women still do not earn as much as men do, 77%. Overall, as men do. And I know some people say, well, different occupations, but even within the same occupation, you get occupational differences. So that's a huge issue. But I would say, secondly, that much of the poverty has to do with the way that women are concentrated at the bottom of the occupational ladder. For example, about one in seven women, not African-American women, women who have a college degree are working in clerical occupations where basically pay is less. So there remains an issue of discrimination. As I pointed out earlier, there have been several studies by economists that say that Tamika will get a job less likely than Tammy will. That, to use your own name, Rashad, you know, Robert will get the job before you do. That's discrimination. Right. And so, you know, while I think you've made some good points, you know, my responses are, you know, the analysis that Dr. King offered is still, unfortunately, very prescient.
That is Dr. Julian Malveaux, and she is our guest today on St. Louis on the Air. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment and encourage your calls. We have several, and we have several emails we want to get to, and we will as soon as we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our conversation with Dr. Julian Malveaux, economist, political commentator, author. And she's going to be in St. Louis on the 21st to take part in observances of Dr. Martin Luther King's day on January 21st. That will be at the University of Missouri, St. Louis at the Two Hill. More on that just a little bit later. I'd like to get right to the phones, Dr. Malveaux. We have a number of callers who want to chat. So let's begin with Mike calling from North St. Louis. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, good morning. In response to the guy saying that Mr. Smiley and West flattening Obama, the man is not flattening his tires. He's just speaking on a legitimate topic of poverty. And so far as whether Mr. Rashad knows it or not, black men did not vote for Mr. Obama in this last election. It was the black women. And so far as the amount of vote, you know, we, the African Americans, voted more and so far as part of this coalition than Hispanics, homosexuals, and white women when it comes down to the number of votes, black women. And black men are just saying, looking at, we voted for this guy overwhelmingly, 95%. What did we get through the first term? Two Supreme Court openings, a Hispanic and a Jewish woman. He's rewrite laws for these homosexuals, and he's allowing these illegal immigrants just devastating the South. I'm 62 years old. I just come from living in the South for 5 years, taking care of an ill aunt down in Tennessee. The illegal immigration and right-to-work states have killed young African-Americans so far as jobs and young whites. Young whites are beginning to rebel because they will come in and just, well, you got poor blacks, poor whites, then you're going to put a third a poverty group on someone, that's why it was a tremendous increase in your food stamps. So, and so far as young blacks being aware of racism, I believe the ones who may, you know, maybe two-parent families, but after seeing some of the smears and doing this campaign against Barack Obama with Netanyahu coming over here, campaigning against a standing president who's black, what that guy hollered out from South Carolina, young African Americans are well aware. And so far as black baseball, sir, if you would drive down Kings Highway and Highway 70, they play baseball all the time at Matthew Dickey. They play baseball at Ozzie Smith Baseball Park across the street from Vashon. So there are thousands of legitimate young African Americans who can play baseball. But for some reason, these white owners and you know, quote, for that concern, a person like LaRusa have devastated.
Okay, Mike, we got you. You're rambling on, I'm afraid, and time is limited. A lot of people want to talk to our guest. I think the comment I made regarding baseball was that a lot of black professional baseball players are not aware of Jackie Robinson and the role he played. But let's put that aside and let Dr. Malveaux discuss some of the other things that you brought up with regard to immigration, for instance.
You know, immigration, we took Mexico. It used to be, we took parts of Mexico because Mexico used to be its own country with a number of Louisiana Purchase, et cetera. You know, we basically took over a part of that country. So I'm often tickled by the conversation about immigration because it really suggests, as many things do, a lack of history, a lack of our history. The second thing I would say is that we would not have an immigration problem if we did not have an economic problem in Mexico. In other words, many people come not because they want to be in the United States, but because they want to improve their economic circumstances. There was just a piece about the number of Mexicans who were going to Canada to work about 6 months in basically in agriculture, and then they go back home and they had enough money to, you know, live not only for the rest of the year but to help out other families. So we want to look a little bit at what's going on with economic conditions. Why do people come here? It's not just because they want the American dream. They want the American paycheck. And so we've got to just be very cognizant about that. Now, there are some issues, of course, when you flood a labor market, especially a labor market that's not well-educated and that is low-income or lower-income, and you flood that labor market, you are going to see wages for everyone go down. You're going to see challenges, especially among young, less-educated African-Americans and whites. And that's just real. I'm not sure there's anything that can be done about it. But I do think the issue of undocumented immigration, I wouldn't say illegal, I use the term undocumented, but you know, the issue of undocumented migration is one that we're going to have to deal with, and I think the Obama administration is going to have to do more than the DREAM Act, which is wonderful, which allows young people who've grown up in this country who are undocumented to be able to go to school, but they've grown up in this country. So we've got a lot of unsolved issues, and this issue is one that comes up like every 20 years. I remember working White House Council of Economic Advisors when Ray Marshall was the Secretary of Labor. And at that point, he estimated about 10 million undocumented people here in the United States. And some tweaks were done to the laws, and then here we are again. And it's going to continue to happen unless we figure out a way to deal with our immigration policy. Now, the other thing I would say to the gentleman who just called is he said black men did not vote for President Obama. That's just not true. 96% of the African-American population voted for President Obama. Now, among men, the amount may have been a little bit lower than among women, but with a 96% rather, vote for President Obama, African-American men could not have been as far off the mark from that. Maybe it was 94%. But that's still, among African-American people, was an overwhelming majority. As he said, it was higher than for white women. It was higher than for undocumented people. It was higher than undocumented people can't vote for, so the Latino population. It was higher than for the gay and lesbian community, the GBLT community. So we, despite our criticisms of the president, felt very strongly about him. Now, again, African Americans are overwhelmingly Democrats, so that's another part of it. And the final thing I would say is, of course, no one takes any exception to what Tavis Smiley and Cornel West are doing around poverty. I think it's really important. I think the previous caller simply was pointing out that the origins of this work may not have been as scholarly as they were personal.
We have an email here, which is an interesting one, Dr. Melvo, from Terry. He identifies himself as a black American. He says, as a business owner in construction and property, the work ethic and attitudes are not there. In trying to run a successful business as an African American, I can no longer take the chance with people of color. A lot of African Americans create a bad first impression by how they dress and talk. For example, pants hanging down, using foul language, etc. As a black owner, I don't have the luxury to conduct myself or carry myself in that manner and cannot come into customers' home with people like that.
Well, I think the gentleman is doing some stereotyping, but I don't think he is off mark from the perspective that we talked earlier about the networks that people have. If African Americans don't have the same networks and access, they really don't know. Lots of people don't know. And I'm not just African Americans. You know, a lot of young people who, again, are working class, who haven't had doors open to them and people to say, this is how you do it, that show up, as the owner said, with, you know, inappropriate attire, inappropriate language. And they really just have to be told, this is how you do it. I think the employers who will give people a chance and say, look, these are our expectations. I think that those kind of folks end up with very loyal workforces and people who really do appreciate that possibility. So, it's an interesting dilemma, but I think oftentimes before the experience has even happened, there's been some stereotyping done.
We have a tweet also, which raises an interesting point worth discussing. It says, black people don't have a black agenda, and we have to establish that before we can do anything.
I think that there's an agenda and there isn't. I don't know how many meetings that I go to where people, let's establish a black agenda. Well, you're going to have a lot of conversation from people across all spectrums talking about what a black agenda is. But from my perspective, here's what it is. Number one, it's more education. Number two, it's more access to any number of things. Number three, it's economic development. And number four, it's the development of equality. I mean, we can crunch around this and put subtitles under those things. I think that's about it. I think people know what we need to do. I think the issue is not only doing it, but pressuring those in legislatures and also in other places. The legislation doesn't solve anything. Legislation, we want to talk about education, we want to talk about the church's role and any number of things. So I don't know how many hours, if not, you know, how much time of my life I've spent sitting around a table talking about black agenda. What happens if you produce one? What's going to be different? We know we need more education. We know we need economic development. We know we need, you know, employment. You know, those are things that are, they're obvious.
Let's go back to the phones and bring in Margarita, who's joining us from Rockford, Illinois. Thank you, Margarita. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity. What I wanted to comment to Dr. Malvo is the constant asking for somebody to do something for us and not finding a way for the communities, as you mentioned something just now, for the communities and the families and us as a group to say, we are going to demand this, just like other groups do, and not asking nicely or just expecting somebody to do something, but organize and educate and become a group that can be identified and move towards something. I have worked in, I'm working as a nurse, and previously I have education as an engineer also, and as you can tell, I have a little bit of an accent. I'm also Latina. So coming to this country, I'm now an American, and I have noticed you want to go and do something in the communities, and the attendance to meetings or these types of reaching out traditionally don't get people in the community to participate. I don't know what is that is needed to get the people going and saying, this is your country, you need to get some part of this piece, a piece of this pie. You need to go and ask for it. You need to also get up in the morning and go to work. It's not that somebody, because it's a president, is going to come and give you something. There is work that needs to be done by each of us. And that's the part that I don't think it gets through the individual, especially the very young ones. And I don't know if we have to take responsibility as parents because of that, but that part is what is missing, I think.
Thank you, Margarita. Dr. Melo.
I think that's a very, very thoughtful comment. Couple of things. When she talks about demanding, I think that that is very thoughtful. I think that post the 60s, you haven't seen the kind of focus in the African-American community where people are out making demands. I think instead people have the focus shifted, I think, from demands to legislative action. And as I said earlier, legislative action has significant limitations. People always say you don't want to see two things made. One is sausage and the other is legislation. Because, you know, as we saw with our most recent fiscal cliff conversations, you don't really want to know what happened. Well, you do and you don't, because there was some, you know, ugly trading that was done there. So I think the whole issue of demanding is really important. And I think the other issue, of course, you said let's get to work, and everybody does need to work, but work isn't there. The work is not there. Or if it's there, it's uncompensated. I mean, there are lots of volunteer opportunities for young people, but, you know, this transcends race. You're looking at young people ages, you know, college grads, ages 22 to 30, really, who have not been able to find work in their field, who are, you know, I know young people who are interns at the in Congress, unpaid interns, and then they work a waiter's job at night so they have enough money to pay their rent. So you have a lot of that going on. And I think for younger people, we have to be cognizant of what kind of labor market they're going into. At the same time, back in the Depression, or I mean, you know, not to go all the way back there, but you've seen people create work. You've seen people, you know, create work for themselves. You know, entrepreneurship is about ingenuity. It's about the way that you create something that someone's going to want. And one of the things I like to see is more entrepreneurship on the part of young people. You see a lot of it around IT, but I'd like to see more of it. Yeah.
Let's take a call from John, who's been very patient. He's on a cell phone. So, John, thanks on both counts for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on the air. Dr. Malvo, I'd like to thank you for all of your insights. I just wanted to make one observation that President Obama, much like Martin Luther King, I believe, is setting an example that we don't pay enough attention to, and that is as a father and as a husband. Many of the young impoverished individuals are growing up in homes, single mothers or whatever, single parents. And I think that President Obama on several occasions has made reference to the fact that the black men need to be accountable for their families and set an example. So I just wanted to say that I didn't hear her say that, Dr. Malvo say that. And I think that's one of the things that Dr. King and Barack Obama have done very well in their life.
You know, that's a really great point, and thank you for bringing it up. I think that you have seen, and it's very exciting, the one picture that everyone loves is the young black boy who's in the White House, and he wants to feel the president's hair, and the president leans down for him to feel it, and he says, feels just like mine. So for many African-American men especially, women as well, but for men especially, he is a role model. He's a black man who's made it, and a lot of people really are excited about that. I think Michelle Obama is a great role model as well. I mean, she's lovely, she's fit. And both of them clearly exemplify what happens not only in a nuclear family, but also an extended family where Michelle's mom comes in to help because she knows that her daughter is going to be very busy in her first term as first lady. So, you know, no, they do, with so many people portraying African-American families as deficient, that something's wrong with single mom, et cetera, this is a family that shows a great example. Let me also say, though, my mom was divorced when I was six. I've got four siblings, and among that group, you've got a PhD, you've got two MBAs, you've got someone with two master's degrees. To be a single mom in and of itself is not a deficiency. To be a single mom who does not have access becomes a problem. So I often get a little annoyed at the focus on single mothers without the focus on where their economic circumstances are.
Well, our time has gone by so very, very quickly, Dr. Malvo. I wish we had more of it, but I want to thank you so very much for being with us, and we look forward to seeing you, as I've said before, a little later this month for the Dr. King observance at the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
Thank you, and I hope you'll come up and introduce yourself so we can talk a little
bit. I would love to meet you in person, yes. Thank you
so
much.
Great. Thank you, and thank your listening audience.
I certainly will. By the way, St. Louis Public Radio Fellowship producer Aaron Williams has a guide highlighting many local events honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It includes Julianne Malveaux's speech at UMSL on January 21st. I should also point out that this Saturday at the main auditorium at Harris Stowe State University, there will be a Martin Luther King State Celebration Commission event. That's at 6:30 p.m. at Harris Stowe. You can visit our homepage at stlpublicradio.org for more information. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about citizen science with the founder of Monarch Watch, an organization focused on the education, research, and conservation of monarch butterflies, and with a local fifth-grade teacher who has been involved in the project for some 20 years now. Also, local citizen science efforts to document frogs and much more about our environment. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.